Okay, we're going to be coming back real soon here. Expect a countdown in just a couple moments. How are we doing, Steve?
He's the only one up there so far.
Okay, so well, we got Lee Dickinson who's really driving this thing along, so he's pounding the gavel. We'll give you a countdown as soon as we're ready. Probably as soon as you hear that gavel go down is when we'll start panicking. Okay, here we go. Hey, Steve, come on. Okay, gang, here we go.
I'd like to call to the witness stand.
Coming down.
Mr. Bruce Blanford.
3, 2, 1.
And live from the Captain Cook Hotel, this is Steve Heimel with Bruce Melzer. And once again, we're ready to resume with the National Transportation Safety Board hearings into the wreck of the Exxon Valdez. The next witness to be called will be the man who relieved the man we just heard, Gordon Taylor. It will be Bruce Blanford, also known as Skip, who came on watch. He's being sworn now. He came on watch just a couple of moments before the Exxon Valdez went aground on Bly Reef. And he was in the control room at the Coast Guard vessel traffic office.
And by whom are you employed?
U.S. Coast Guard.
In what capacity?
A vessel traffic controller, GS-9.
Mm-hmm. And approximately how long have you been in this position?
Since August of 1986.
Do you hold any licenses or documents as a seaman?
I have a uninspected passenger vessel license, which I've held since 1978, I believe.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson, would you continue?
Good afternoon, Mr. Blanford. Mr. Blanford, were you a vessel traffic controller prior to 1986?
No, sir.
Could you describe your training that you received in preparation of becoming a controller?
We were given the materials which Mr. Taylor discussed previously, the traffic center manual, the traffic service manual, area familiarization, which is similar to a test for pilotage endorsements, a blank chart that you have to fill in the names of prominent points, buoys, markers, names of islands, bodies of water.
Are you required to requalify each year?
Technically, yes.
Could you describe what those requirements are?
To take vessel familiarization rides, tanker rides, tug rides.
How many rides must you take?
I believe it's one each.
Are there any consequences if you don't, if you're not able to take these rides?
As of this date, no.
Do you believe that these qualifying trips are beneficial?
Yes, I do.
Could you explain?
So that you maintain familiarity with the operation of the bridge on a ship, so that you hear from the other end what you sound like, what kind of job Vessel Traffic Service is doing for the shipping community. I think it's valuable training.
Have you made any requalification trips since you were hired on as a controller?
Only the initial trip.
Sir, would you describe your duties as a vessel traffic controller, what you view your responsibilities are and your duties?
My impression of the job is to keep the traffic moving safely and smoothly. I have a number of means at my disposal. By the movement reporting system, which some of the vessels are mandated to participate in the system. They relay their courses, speeds, intentions, and ETAs. to me. I relay those to other vessels so they can make appropriate plans for passing arrangements, so on and so forth. I advise vessels of possible hazardous conditions in existence, such as high winds in the Narrows, ice in the Bly Reef area. And we maintain the one-way zone so that two tank vessels don't meet one another in that zone. That's a nutshell.
Do you feel that the Raytheon radar that's presently installed in the VTC is adequate? Adequate for monitoring the Narrows and Valdez Arm out the Bly Reef?
I believe it's adequate for monitoring the Narrows. It would depend on what you would want it to do. If you to say adequate for monitoring the arm, you'd have to further define that.
Do you believe that the Raytheon units are capable of monitoring and tracking vessels out to Bly Reef on a regular basis?
On a regular basis, regular meaning 100% of the time.
What would be a fair estimate of, I'd say at least 90% of the time?
Okay, I would say like a nominal percent of the time it's adequate. Under some conditions, there are no radars that I've seen, at least the ones installed, either these or the previous ones, that under certain conditions, you just cannot count on 100% of the time coverage.
The radar that is installed, is that a 3-centimeter radar?
I believe that's 10.
You believe it's a 10-centimeter radar?
I'm not sure.
Is this radar particularly sensitive to rain and sea clutter?
Yes, it is. You can see, you can pick up weather on it quite well. And to quite an altitude, up to 2,000 feet.
Have you had any problems plotting and tracking vessels in the Valdez Narrows?
None that I'm aware of.
Could you describe the policies for monitoring vessels or plotting vessels prior to the day of the accident in the Valdez Narrows or in Prince William Sound?
Prior to the accident, the policy was to monitor the traffic in the port, in the arm, and the rest of the system by whatever means available. And in the Narrows, they would be tracked using the data logger at a 3-minute interval.
When you say monitor, is it just visually observing the radar scope? Is that what you view
monitor,
as monitoring?
Monitor to me means to keep track of the vessels by whatever means available. If you don't have radar coverage, you monitor them by their progress reports given to you over the radio.
Prior to the day of the accident, was the Raytheon unit capable of automatically acquiring and plotting vessels in the Valdez Narrows and the Valdez Arm at the same time, simultaneously?
We've never had the ability to automatically acquire. The radar has to acquire a target by manual means. There is an auto-acquire function on those machines, but that's for shipboard use. If you use it in a land-based installation, it acquires all the mountaintops and forgets about the ship. But we did manually acquire the vessels in the Narrows.
I have in front of me a memorandum, exhibit 7 Alpha. 7 Delta, pardon me.
The usual shuffling of papers when everybody looks up their exhibits.
This memorandum dated 31 August 1987.
Mr. Johnson, can you identify what that memorandum is?
It's a memorandum from RD1 Moore Day Worker to all VTC traffic watchstanders. Mr. Blanford, you were a watchstander at the time this memo was issued.
That's correct.
The memo makes reference to the fact that prior to the 31 August 87, vessels were plotted from the 15-mile mark southwest of Potato Point.
Okay, in this instance, the word plot means manually recording the bearing and range on a piece of paper, table.
It doesn't mean plotting it on a chart?
Not on a chart, nor a chartlet.
Just recording the range of bearing, similar to what the data logger does today?
That's correct.
What was that information used for, other than historical record?
Historical purposes. If someone were to get into trouble, any kind of trouble you can imagine. I can't think of any instance where we had to use that information, but you did have it available for reference. If there were to be an accident, let's say if a tanker and a small boat were to collide, and in a later proceeding, we're trying to figure out where, in fact, he was, we'd have that historical data.
Blanford, will you describe the events that took place between the time you reported to the MSO Valdez station on the 23rd of March, 1989, and the sequence of events that occurred after that?
The best that I can recall, I arrived at the station approximately 23:40. I immediately went upstairs and went into the traffic center and started relieving the watch with Mr. Taylor. We spent several minutes going over the pending traffic. I ascertained from him what the ice situation was. And as best as I can recall, he told me that the Exxon Valdez was outbound. He had dropped the pilot and he was gone from the radar. I can't exactly recall whether or not he gave me the course or I determined that later, but he said that he would be crossing into the separation zone and possibly into the northbound lane and would call me shortly with an ice report and an updated ETA for Naked Island. I believe Mr. Taylor left the traffic center as close as I can remember to 23:45. After going back and listening to some of the tapes, he answered one additional radio call after I arrived, being to a different ship, the Exxon San Francisco, I think it was. And that was at 2345, and right after that he left.
And what happened next?
As soon as he left and I got everything sorted out in my mind what was going on, I checked all of the data sheets for the vessels. I believe we had three pending at the time, Exxon Valdez and two other tankers, and I'm not sure if there were any in addition to that, to see where they all were. We each have our little way of keeping things straight in our head and keeping our watch flowing smoothly. I'm left-handed, the rest of them are right-handed, so they all set their sheets up this way and I set mine up this way, so I go through and get them where I can understand them, and I generally lay from left to right there. You see where the log book is on the left under number 3 radar. I more or less determine that position as being Hinchinbrook, and the further they get around toward from left to right, if they end, their sheets end up all the way over on the right-hand side, they would be in Valdez, and that way I keep moving them. And well, it's fairly easy to tell. When this fella calls up, you know to call this fellow and this fellow on either side of him, depending on which way he's going. After I got things squared away, so to speak, I went down and got a cup of coffee. I may have been gone a couple of minutes. I really couldn't say how long. I checked the weather office on the way back to see what kind of weather systems we could be expecting, you know, if there was going to be any worry for high winds. We had just gone through quite a period of heavy weather during February, and I make it a practice to go in and check what the wind situation is, both in the Narrows and at berth 4 at the terminal.
And what happened next?
It wasn't too long after that, maybe 5 minutes. I started on my midnight duties that we do every night at midnight, that being changing the tape on the 40-channel recorder. That process takes anywhere from 2 to 5 minutes. You have to unload, pull the recently completed tape off the machine, file it away, make out a little card that identifies the tape, the day, that, and the names of the watch standers that were on that particular day. You have to get a new tape out and erase it with a bulk tape eraser. Then you have to clean the tape heads with a cotton swab and alcohol.
We're hearing a list of the routine of changing the watch at midnight at the Coast Guard Vessel Traffic Control Center in Valdez from the Alaska Public Radio Network and KSKA Anchorage. You're listening to live coverage of the National Transportation Safety Board public hearing into the wreck of the Exxon Valdez.
Audible alarm that starts, or it goes off right at midnight, and you have to punch it, even though the other one has started, to silence the alarm. After that, I did the daily tallies for the totals we keep for record purposes. This involves taking the past day's data sheets off of their file, tally them up by category, record the numbers, and staple them together, and then record the numbers in another book. On that particular night, I think I went through the, we have a pending board, which vessels are in the sound, but they're not checked into the system. So periodically, usually the mid-watch fellow will go through there to make sure, well, you know, this tug has been sitting on here for 2 weeks, and he's obviously not here anymore. He either went out the back door or something happened, but he's not here. So you go through the pending board and try to purge that, and that takes a little bit longer, and I believe I did that night. After that, I made the mid-watch entry in the unit log, which requires you to get a bearing and range to Middle Rock so you keep your radar calibrated. The bearing and range should be 1.97 nautical miles from Potato Point. That's if everything's in calibration. And if it's way out from that, then of course you want to get technical help to remedy the situation.
And what happened next?
Well, in order to make the mid-watch entry, I had to change the radar up to the 3-mile scale. Actually, it was 1.5 mile, gives you a better picture. And at that time, I did that, made the mid-watch entry, and that was about all that happened for several minutes.
What time was that approximately?
Well, I'm going to guess. I actually didn't know until I sat down on the next following set of mid-watches and more or less clocked myself through this whole procedure. And it took me that particular day, it took me about 15 minutes.
If you had required technical help, how long would it have taken to have somebody come in to help you out?
Depending what the situation might be.
As far as the radar.
If the heading flash would have been off, let's say, probably half an hour.
And what happened next?
The next thing that happened was when the Exxon Valdez called and said that he was hard aground on Bly Reef. This was at 0028.
And you were in the 1.5 mile scale at that time?
Right.
Was that the master radar or the slave?
That was the master.
Mr. Taylor mentioned to you the course change that the Exxon Valdez took to 200?
Like I said earlier, I can't recall whether or not he specifically said 200, or all I remember him saying is that he was going into the separation zone, or possibly the southbound lane, or the northbound lane, to wind his way through ice, and that he would call me shortly with an ice report and a new ATA for Naked Island.
After the Exxon Valdez called you about 0028, what happened next?
I immediately flipped the radar back up on 12-mile scale before I even answered him. And I did see him down there, broadside, to the radar. Looked like he was on a heading of about 260. I originally acquired him. I'd have to refer to my log entry there, but I originally acquired him using the acquisition capability. And I got his bearing and range from the target acquisition data on the Raycast computer. Okay, and that's the initial figure that I put in the logbook. I think it was 203 or 204. And then a while later, I went back because I saw that the acquisition wasn't exactly in the middle of the target. I went back and I got a manual using the electronic bearing line and the VRM to get a manual bearing and range, which turned out to be a degree different.
And after you observed the Valdez on the radar, what happened next?
I rogered for his position, and then I immediately called the commanding officer.
Could you relate to us the conversation you had with the commanding officer?
The Exxon Valdez is hard aground on Bly Reef, leaking oil, and I think you better get to the station as soon as possible.
After he called the CO, what happened next?
He asked me to call the XO, which I did, and told him the same thing, virtually.
And what happened after that?
I called the tug stalwart. That's the, at the time, was a standby tug at Alyeska Terminal. Told him what had happened and requested that he get underway for possible assistance just as soon as possible.
What happened after the stalwart was notified?
Shortly after that, I called the Marine supervisor over at the terminal, told him what had happened, and that the Exxon Valdez head was in fact leaking oil, and that he'd better muster his cleanup crew ASAP.
About what time was that?
Oh, gee. Do you have my log in here? Do you know?
This is Skip Blanford. He came on watch a little before midnight, just before the Exxon Valdez went aground. He's a Coast Guard traffic controller. And he's talking about what he did after he found out that the vessel had gone hard aground and was probably spilling a good bit of its cargo into Prince William Sound. We will continue to go live with this past the 5 o'clock mark unless there's some kind of break here.
Here it is.
Referring to his log to as to the time when he got in touch with the Alyeska tug about doing something about the oil.
Apparently I didn't log that, but it was just a few minutes after I called the stalwart that I contacted a Marine supervisor. Unfortunately, I did it on the terminal hotline, and it's not on the recorder either.
Your logbook indicates that you called the tug stalwart at 0032, so it was shortly thereafter.
Right.
Can you give us
5 minutes?
Within 5 minutes.
It was before I believe, as best as I can remember, it was before the commanding officer and executive officer arrived at the station, that I had called Mr. Barnum over at Alyeska.
And what happened next?
Then we asked the pilot vessel Bering to provide some assistance, since he was the closest available boat and or resource in the area. And we asked him to, if he could please send a boat down to evaluate the situation with the Exxon Valdez, and if he could send his other boat, the speedboat, into town to pick up some Coast Guard personnel to take them out to the ship.
And what happened next?
Well, it was just a very short period of time. Commanding officer and executive officer arrived at the station, and this commanding officer immediately communicated, I believe, with the master of the Exxon Valdez. I can't remember word for word what transpired, but from then on, I did not play much more of an active role in the incident itself.
Were you requested to stay on duty past your regular normal watch hours?
Yes, things as the hours went on, as you can well imagine, got quite hectic. We had some extra people in, and the phone lines were just constantly ringing, and we had no relief for the traffic watch standard. So I more or less stayed on at the commanding officer's request for an additional 4 hours to try to help out, mainly by answering the phones.
And what time did you leave the station?
Approximately 11:45.
Which, was the commanding officer aware that you had left the station?
Yes.
When you relieved Mr. Taylor, did you have the opportunity to look at the radar before he left?
Yes, I did.
And you did not see anything?
There was no target on the radar.
And it was on the 1.5 mile range scale?
No.
Was it?
It was, that particular indicator was set on the 6 mile range scale, offset to 10 miles.
That particular indicator, meaning the slave indicator?
No, the master.
The master was on a 6 mile scale?
Yes, sir.
And what was the slave indicator on?
I believe it was on 3 mile scale.
Blanford, since the accident, have there been any additional plotting requirements implemented? And if so, could you describe them?
Yes, the Commandant has ordered that a physical plot on a chartlet be kept for each vessel from Bligh Reef to the dock, or from Bligh Reef buoy, and vice versa. With the same interval, 6 minutes outside the narrows, 3 minutes within the narrows.
Inbound vessels, when are you picking them up now? How far out?
It depends on the conditions.
You've mentioned a couple occasions, it depends on the conditions, on how effective the radar is.
If you have If you have 2 weeks of bright sunny days and clear nights, you're going to have 2 weeks of 100% acquisition. Now, if it's raining very heavily, you might not pick the guy up until he gets to Rocky Point.
What percentage of the time would you describe the conditions as being optimum for maximum radar range?
You'd probably do better talking to a weatherman about that, but I'll take a stab at it. 60%.
What was your occupation prior to becoming a vessel traffic controller?
Well, I spent 14 years active duty in the Coast Guard, the last three of which were in Valdez. And I was the operations officer when I got out of the Coast Guard in 1980.
What were your duties as a operations officer?
Well, I was overseeing the operation of the Vessel Traffic Center, the communications, meaning the radio watch. I was also the electronics material officer. I was responsible to supervise the military technicians and two civilian technicians who are on contract. The plant was a little bit different then. I also functioned as a supply officer for part of that time and various other collateral duties.
When you say the plant was different, what were you making reference to?
Well, the radars were different, as you well know, and some of the radio sites that were in existence then have since been deinstalled, and some additional sites have been placed in service.
When you were VTC super operations officer, were you VTC qualified at the time?
I was the, pardon?
You were the watchstanding, you were the operations officer, is that correct? And you oversaw the VTC.
Right.
Were you watchstander qualified?
Well, at that time, I was qualified as a vessel traffic watch officer.
And could you describe the difference between the two? Is there a difference?
At that time, the watchstanders had a direct supervisor who was at the station 24 hours a day. And this was the vessel traffic watch officer. The minimum requirements for that being that you had to be a qualified deck watch officer on a vessel.
How can you compare, or would you compare, the previous radar system, the AL system, and the current Raytheon system as far as its effectiveness?
Well, each one has its pluses and minuses. And it's quite a long time ago that I don't remember all the peculiarities of the AIL system. I do recall from functioning as the EMO, the electronics material officer, that we did have quite a bit more downtime with the other system than has been my experience to be familiar with since August 1986 with the new system. As far as the user friendliness of the old system, it wasn't very. You had to manually take bearing and ranges. There was no acquisition of targets, automatic tracking, or any of that. Those niceties that we have now, and which make for a much better watch, I believe, because instead of having to do all this stuff by hand, you can concentrate on more and what's on more of what is going on around you in terms of traffic. The old system had one feature that would be desirable in the new system, and that would be was the ability to offset the scope way off the screen. You could, on the 6 mile range, for instance, you could offset the origin completely off the screen so that you were looking at the Bligh Reef area, for instance, on the 6 mile scale. And in that manner, you could pick up ice better. And that is the only advantage that I can recall there being to that radar.
When you plotted vessels using the old system, were the procedures different?
Okay.
When you took range and bearing, did you plot it on?
You're talking sheets? About when I was on active duty?
Yes, sir.
Yes, we used plotting sheets because we did not have the automatic target acquisition. It is my understanding, and I can't say this with any authority because I wasn't there when they changed the radars, but when they deinstalled the ALs and installed the Raytheons and began taking advantage of the automatic tracking functions, then they went to a new style plotting sheet, which did not involve a chartlet. It's strictly recording the bearing and range in conjunction with your little timer.
And you feel that is as effective as the previous system?
Certainly.
Stated that you were...
Well, let me qualify that. Providing your radar is in calibration. If it gets too far out of calibration, as I referred back here to where I acquired the target of the Exxon Valdez, and it was one bearing, and then I took a manual bearing, and it was a different bearing. If your target window is not properly calibrated, you're not going to get as accurate a reading as if you take a manual fix on it.
You stated earlier that you were a qualified OOD when you were in the Coast Guard. Is that correct? Did you have the opportunity to sail using the current Raytheon system, the 64?
No, I don't think it was invented yet.
Can you describe some of the changes that have been made to VTC, vessel traffic control procedures since the accident, reference to ice or plotting?
I just did that.
Well, it's in reference to ice. ICE reports our vessels being monitored more closely when the ice has been reported? Or?
No. We have, I don't understand what you mean by monitor more closely. We have the 6 minute plot and we're constantly watching them. We have an additional person in there just to do the plotting.
Do you know if the current radar is an X-band or an S-band radar? X-band or an S-band?
I really couldn't tell you.
Thank you. That's all the questions I have.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Dr. Berkey?
Chairman, I have a couple of questions. Mr. Blanford, have you ever had a suspicion or have you ever discussed within the office the issue of whether vessels report ice heavier than usual or than it really is in order to cut time off the arm in terms of sailing time?
No. No, it is, it's not. What you're inferring is that it's a common occurrence for them to take a shortcut, and no, I've not observed that at all.
Okay. I'd like to ask you some questions about the toxicology testing that went on in your position after the grounding. I understand. Well, would you tell us what you did when you left the center after you got off duty on the 24th?
I went home.
And were you subsequently called back in for providing a specimen for toxicology testing?
Yes, sir.
Do you know when that was, under what circumstances that was done?
It was approximately 1400 that day.
And could I refer you to Exhibit 2F, page 2, if you would?
One moment.
Page 2, please. I think it's page 2. I better check. Okay. It's the table 1 of that document is what I want.
Dr. Merritt Berkey from the technical panel of the National Transportation Safety Board is questioning Bruce Blandford, who was the working at the Valdez Traffic Control Center at the time that the Exxon Valdez went to ground.
For ethanol at 0.2%, is that your understanding?
Well, I was not recalled until 1400, and the time on here looks accurate.
Okay. All right. Can you explain the circumstances of that value, urine value? For ethanol?
Well, after I'd finished my 8-hour watch and put in 4 more hours of mayhem, I was pretty stressed out and pretty tired by the time I got home, and I had my wife came home from her job for lunch, and we sat down and discussed it a little bit, and I took a couple of drinks more or less calm down, and I had fully intended within an hour or so to go to bed.
Then what happened?
About the time my head was to hit the pillow, the phone rang, and I was ordered to return to the station.
For what purpose?
For this drug testing.
Pardon me?
For this drug testing.
And who called you, and what was the rationale given for providing that specimen?
As I recall, it was the I'll need some help here. I don't remember who called at this point.
Up for questioning is Bruce Blandford, who is a vessel traffic controller at the Coast Guard Center in Valdez. The NTSB investigator and toxicology specialist, Dr. Merritt Berkey, just confronted him with the fact that his blood alcohol level, he tested positive for alcohol shortly after going off duty, and Blanford's providing his explanation. He's now hunting around for the paperwork to find out who it was who called him back so he could provide a sample for that drug test.
Pardon?